Welcome to today's interview here on Brighteon.com. And today we're very honored to be joined by just a top analyst, a very important voice for our time, Colonel Douglas McGregor. Welcome, Colonel. It's just an honor to have you on the show. We love and appreciate your work and appreciate your time.
Good. Happy to be back. Thanks.
It's great to have you back. So let's start with the fact that Trump has launched more airstrikes now in his first 6 months of his presidency than Joe Biden did in his entire 4 years. How does this square with the idea of being the peace president?
Well, it's hard to make the argument, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
I think people are beginning to look at what's happening and wondering what they did. One of the phrases I use with people, I said, "Well, I think you got into a car driven by President Trump. You got out of the car that was driven by President Biden. You thought you were headed in a new direction. In reality, you just changed lanes."
Ah.
And I think that's effectively what's happened. Now, was President Trump ever going to do all of the things that he said he was going to do? That's a different question. But I think certainly in foreign and defense policy, he's taken a dramatic U-turn from where he was when he ran for office.
Well, you said in a recent interview, because I do watch most of your interviews because I think you're so informative, but you said that you think that Trump himself has a sense of good faith in what he's attempting to do, but he's surrounded by a political infrastructure that is steering him in a completely different direction. Can you offer some more details about that?
Yeah, well, I think you have to see the people that are around him that interact with him on a daily basis. And those people are all rabid neocons. People like Lutnick, Witkoff, Rubio, Hegseth, ultimately Radcliffe over at the CIA, and I'm sure his son-in-law, Kushner. All of these people are basically pushing him in the same direction. Then you also have to take into account the people that donated to his campaign. Where did most of his money come from? And I tell people, you've got to go back and look at the Republican National Convention in August last year. And I don't know if you watched all of it. I did, because I've always watched these conventions whenever I could, even when I was on active duty and frankly growing up, because my mother was very heavily engaged in Republican politics in Pennsylvania. And I was struck, I think it was the second night, could have been the first, I thought it was the second night, when this gentleman walked out onto the stage to the podium, and behind him hung this giant Israeli flag. And above this Israeli flag were the words, "Israel first." And in all of my life, I cannot recall any political convention, certainly not involving either of the main parties, Republican or Democrat, ever flying or posting a foreign flag. And certainly no one ever suggested anything other than the United States and its interests. I'd never seen anything like Israel first. I think many of us were stunned by it and then sort of gradually walked away from it on the assumption that, well, this was important for President Trump's donors, so he did that. I don't think we understood what was happening. And so if you go back to that event and you trace forward, you can see that all of the decisions that are made with that Israel first as the lodestone guiding foreign and defense policy.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. And that clearly is, at least that's my perception as well, and of many. But let me bring up this issue where the Trump administration really differs from Israel's analysis. And that's about the results of the bunker buster bombing of Iran. Now, both Iran and the Trump administration claim that all the nuclear material was destroyed, that the nuclear infrastructure was essentially completely obliterated. That was their claim the very next day, which of course is easy to dispute. But Israel says now, no, it's possible they didn't destroy the 60% enriched uranium, and that we may have to bomb them again. So here we have a split, and Trump recently saying, at least reportedly, that Netanyahu is a bit of a madman. What do you make of that split?
There is no split. If the Israelis want us to re-engage with them against Iran, we will do that. And President Trump has said several times, if it becomes necessary to bomb Iran again, then I will do it. Note the word necessary, whatever that means. I think we have to understand something. Go back to the Netanyahu-Trump meeting in the Oval Office, the last one, not before this, the last one, the one that preceded the bombing. And he sort of sat there grinning like a Cheshire cat on the chair saying, well, we want the Libyan model. In other words, we want to do to Iran what was done to Libya. And then he smiled. Trump didn't really react to it. But I think that Netanyahu was telling the truth. They want Iran to go the way of Libya. We know how things have turned out in Libya. The country was destroyed. It's still divided. It's mired in civil war. And this is after, of course, Gaddafi gave up any nuclear-capable weapons or biological or chemical weapons, whatever he had. He opened everything up to our inspection, let us remove it. And of course, he was rewarded by being attacked and destroyed. That also set in motion, it wasn't the only thing, but it certainly set in motion, the migration out of North Africa towards France, Italy, and into Europe, which is now beginning once again to become a serious problem. So I think we have to go back to that. And I still think that is exactly what Mr. Netanyahu wants. And again, you've got to go back and look at the Israeli view of the world. And their view from the very beginning has always been that if all of their neighbors are trying to kill each other or are in conflict, that that's a permanent strategic benefit to Israel. Well, I understand some of that makes sense. But on the other hand, if you have a policy that foments and cultivates destruction all around you, eventually it's going to turn on you. And I think that's what's really happening right now. But I don't think that was President Trump's preference, but I think that's President Trump's dilemma right now.
Okay. You also said the so-called 12-day war, you were pointing out just how effective Iran's missiles were at bypassing the so-called Iron Dome defenses and achieving kinetic destruction of specific targets in Israel, so some of those being infrastructure targets, such as fuel refineries and ports right. and military targets and so on. Do you think that Trump is willing to go in and resume that war, more bombing of Iran and on behalf of Israel? I think the answer is yes, but what more can the U.S. do other than start to try to put, dare I say, boots on the ground, which would be a suicide mission, I think?
Well, I don't know about that, but I think we have to look at what's been happening in the region, because we're focused almost exclusively on Iran, and yet there are activities in Central Asia, activities in the Caucasus, activities in Syria involving the CIA, MI6 from Britain, the Mossad. We and the Israelis and the British have been stirring up unrest in Central Asia without much success, by the way, in the hopes of creating an Islamist problem for Russia. For instance, after we left Afghanistan, people were shocked to see planes land with pallets of cash that were then picked up from U.S. military transports by the Taliban. And people said, well, why are we sending this material to the Taliban? Well, they weren't going to the Taliban. The shipments of cash were going into Central Asia, into Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, where there are Islamist elements that we've decided to weaponize against Russia. Mm. Now, it hasn't worked out very well because Russia has excellent relations with the Central Asian republics. In fact, the leadership in the Central Asian republics is very friendly to President Putin, because President Putin has been a reliable ally for them and helped them to quell unrest and is seen as a guarantor of security to some extent against China. Now, the people in Central Asia all want to do business with the Chinese, but they don't like the Chinese. And so the Russians interface with these countries so that the Chinese can move in and build infrastructure. And that includes infrastructure that reaches across Central Asia, down through the Caucasus Mountains, and all the way into Iran. And we've already seen the first Chinese rail transport train, if you will, terminate in Tehran. So that route now exists. That infrastructure is only going to grow. At the same time, the Israelis have been very active in cultivating the Azeri Turks in Azerbaijan because the Azeris needed their help and assistance to attack Armenia, which they've done. So Armenia lost territory as well as a lot of soldiers to the Azeris in their attacks a couple of years ago. And much of that success was facilitated by the use of Israeli drones. Now attention has been turned away from Armenia directly towards Iran and secondarily towards Russia. And the effort in Iran is very simply to do to Iran what we failed to do to Russia. You got to go back and look at our original strategy, which was we're going to force regime change. In other words, after all, Putin is a dictator. Nobody likes him, so it'll be easy to remove him from office. Secondly, we're then going to divide up Russia into smaller bites and pieces that then we, and specifically the financial interests in London and New York City, can devour their resources, minerals, and so forth. That's failed. We've lost that war. The best that we can do now, if you're interested in harming Russia, is somehow or another keep the war going in Ukraine to the extent that you can, although I think it's going to be very difficult in the near future. I think that war is coming to a close. But having said that, we've now turned our attention to do the same thing to Iran. The Azeris think they have the opportunity to move into northwestern Iran, which is also Azeri and Turkic, albeit Shia, as far as religion goes. They've been part of the Persian culture and civilization for a long time, but there's this belief that that will cause unrest inside Iran and ultimately help facilitate regime change. At the same time, the Kurds in eastern Syria and northern Syria are working closely with the Israelis, specifically the Mossad, to set up their own independent state. They, in turn, are linked to the Druze, and the Druze are, of course, in southern Syria, and are effectively being annexed to Greater Israel. All of this, of course, brings Iran into collision, not just with the Azeri Turks, but also with us and with the Israelis because we're behind it all. Now it's affected Russia because Russia knows that it cannot afford to lose contact with Iran. It cannot afford a hostile state where Azerbaijan is that could destabilize southern Russia. Remember, southern Russia is very similar in many ways to Mexico for us. In other words, southern Russia is the soft underbelly, the strategic underbelly that's open to attack, and they don't want that. So our involvement, along with the Israelis, is now putting us on a collision course with not just Iran, but also Russia, not just in Eastern Europe with Russia, but now directly in the Caucasus and the Middle East. And then behind all of this, you have Mr. Erdogan, who wants, on the one hand, to support his Turkish brethren, wants to build a greater Turkey, which I don't think is going to happen exactly as he hopes. But at the same time, he's done a deal with the devil being Netanyahu, in order to get control of most of Syria. Only he's finding now that the Israelis are going to attack his surrogates in Syria, which doesn't suit him. Bottom line is, this war is not only not over, it's just beginning.
Right. And perhaps Erdogan needs to reconsider the fact that the greater Israel map encompasses much of southern Turkey also. I mean, that's one of the ultimate aims here.
Well, but I think they're looking also at Egypt.
Yes.
And much of the Egyptian army that is sitting across from the Israeli border. And you have the Israelis who want to push the starving and dying Gazan population into Egypt. Well, Egypt can't absorb any more people. It's got 100 million as it is. And in that sense, it's kind of an economic basket case. But it's also a repository of Arab nationalism. It's the largest Muslim Arab state in the world. And the population is violently anti-Israeli. So General Sisi, who is the leader of the country, has to be very careful how he proceeds. He wants to get along with us, but he knows that if he actually attacks the Israelis trying to push the Gazan population, the Palestinians, into the Sinai, He's not just going to be at war with Israel. He's going to end up at war with us.
Right.
In the meantime, the Russians and the Chinese have come into Egypt to help the Egyptians, the Russians especially. The Russians had a long relationship during the Cold War with the Egyptians. They actually got along very, very well. I think we're going to see a resumption of that, because that's really the only way that General Sisi, his government, and Egypt can survive in the face of Israeli aggression. Because the Israelis very definitely want to capture the Sinai and northern Egypt.
Yeah, and control of the Suez Canal is critical for China and Russia trade, energy movements. But
keep in mind, one of the reasons they're building the One Belt, One Road all over Central Asia is to avoid sea transport. Because they've got a problem. It's called the United States Navy. And with five or six nuclear attack submarines in the U.S. Navy, you could shut down all the coastal traffic, all the sea lanes into and out of China. In other words, nothing goes in, nothing comes out, or you sink it. They know that. So to avoid, you know, being entirely dependent on the sea, they are building this dramatic infrastructure that reaches all the way to Europe, all the way down into the Middle East, the Arabian Peninsula, and ultimately to Africa. That's their purpose. That's an insurance policy against being isolated by the U.S. Navy.
Exactly. All right. Well said. Since you mentioned Russia, let me ask you a question about Trump's threat. He announced a 50-day timetable. I don't know. I've heard Trump's brain described as a random number generator. I thought that was particularly interesting. But it's about 40 days away when Trump promises to put secondary tariffs on any nation that purchases energy from Russia. Now, those secondary tariffs Trump threatens would be 100% on top of whatever existing tariff rates there are. And obviously that would impact China, India, Turkey, I mean, Iran, but even the EU. I mean, the EU purchases gas from Russia, especially since the Nord Stream pipeline is no longer functional. So do you think Trump means what he says on that, or is he going to back down?
Well, let's look at how successful our tariff war has been thus far. The Chinese are now dumping our treasuries at high speed. The treasury market is very, very fragile. In order to attract foreign investment in the United States, which is not coming, by the way, to the United States at this point, you have to raise yields. That means that your 10-year bond is inching up towards the 5% level. The 20 and 30-year treasury bonds are already up at the 5% level. If you hit the 5% level on the 10-year bond, everyone who is knowledgeable about the bond market says that's when we go into default, because we can't pay the interest on our debt any longer. At the same time, you've got Powell, who is the target of abuse for the president, who is doing what he can to suppress interest rates, but he can't suppress them any further. So we're in a very difficult position. The things that he's doing, frankly, are probably irrelevant at this point to the Russians, the Chinese, and others. I mean, at some point you say, well, the hell with the United States. We're just going to do business on our own. That's called de-dollarization. And we're well underway to de-dollarization. And in fact, as Nassim Taleb has pointed out, the reserve currency is no longer the dollar, it's gold.
It's gold, that's right.
And I think increasingly you're going to see these currencies, the RMB is going to be pegged to gold. It's going to be a game changer. So whether we like it or not, I think the world is simply going to move on without us. And if anything, we're going to find ourselves increasingly isolated. Everybody, whether it's Mexico, Brazil, Peru, doesn't make any difference, wants to join BRICS. Contrary to what President Trump said publicly, all BRICS is fading. It's absolutely untrue. It's the opposite. And you have the Shanghai Cooperation Council, all these other entities and trade relationships that have grown up in Asia, and now with Southwest Asia, India, the Arab world, and Africa, we're not as relevant as we once were. Uh-huh. I'm also being told that we were a few years ago, 2 years ago, 23% of the world's gross domestic product. I'm told now we're not even 20%.
Yeah.
So our share of all of this is weakening. And at some point you have to wake up and smell the coffee and say, wait a minute, what am I doing? And I think President Trump isn't there yet, but I think he'll get there. The problem is, I think when he gets there, it'll probably be too late.
I think it is too late in many areas. In fact, I'd love to hear your reaction to this. Yesterday, the White House put out the AI.gov report, an effort to try to achieve AI dominance. At the same time, I posted this article, the AI race is already won. It's been won by China, and here's why. If you look at this, you see this chart, top power producing countries. Yes. You see China produces 10,000 terawatt hours annually. The US produces 4,400 terawatt hours. And by the way, the 10 new nuclear plants that Trump is planning would bring this 4.4K to 4.5K, in case anybody's wondering. And those nuclear power plants wouldn't open until the 2040s because of how long it takes. So China is well ahead, and the AI race is a power intensive race. And the entire Eastern power grid, I think it's called the JPL power grid, the 13 states in Virginia and DC, has just announced no more AI data centers are allowed because they're maxed out. They've got no more power, right? Yeah. So, Colonel.
By the way, they're also an environmental hazard, and they affect the water. There are undetected radiation that's coming out that's beginning to have an impact. I'm in Northern Virginia, so I can tell you the people that live here are saying, hell no, we don't want any more of this. We don't want to live near it.
They see nuclear power plants?
No. I'm talking about data centers.
Oh, the data centers. Oh. Okay. What are the emissions that you're referring to?
I am not familiar with the details. I just know that communities that are living near data centers are saying that the water that they're getting is no longer purified. You can't drink it. They're saying that they are emitting radiation in greater quantities than originally promised. I don't know. What I'm trying to do, though, is reinforce your point.
Yes.
No more data centers.
Well, yeah, perhaps some data centers are using surface water for cooling, possibly, and they're just pumping that through and dumping it back out, and then the water temperatures are changing algae growth or that's interesting. But what I wanted to point out in this and get your reaction is that I did all the math on this. We would have had to have started a national emergency power expansion program in the year 2010 in order to be competitive with China in the AI race. But that didn't happen.
Well, listen, I think you've just hit on a very important point. Some of your viewers may remember that when Obama came in, he talked about a massive infrastructure program. And that program involved billions of dollars. Well, where did all the money go?
Yeah.
What happened? Well, they talked about shovel-ready programs. Ultimately, it went to Obama supporters, firms, corporations, individuals that had contributed to Obama's election. In other words, not much happened that was of any long-term value, but I can tell you, having been there at the time, along with a number of other consulting firms, ARES was brought in, and we all said the same thing. You've got to modernize the electric grid. You know, we've all been through all of the various war games and simulations that show where all the nodes are for power and electricity. We know what their vulnerabilities are. And so we laid this out for people in the Obama administration and said, look, this is where we've got to go. We need to bury all the power lines. I mean, if you go to Europe right now, particularly Central and Northern Europe and Western Europe, you rarely, if ever, see power lines. They've all been buried. They're underground. In other words, they're secure. And we've got to secure the whole grid. The whole grid is anachronistic. It's old technology. It can't handle the loads.
That's right.
So all of this was briefed to the Obama administration. We know what happened. Nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, dead right.
I want to give out your website, douglasmcgregor.com. And I just want to ask you, Colonel, what is your focus these days? I mean, I know you're busy with lots of interviews and speeches and many things, but what's your focus?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First of all, I think that we are on the edge of the proverbial abyss. I think the financial crisis that's coming is going to have a terrible impact here. You know, Jamie Dimon just a few days ago talked about the bond market, which we were discussing earlier. And he said the crack in the system is widening so quickly that we could end up in a situation far worse than anything we saw in 2008 that would probably look closer to the Depression. Now, this is Jamie Dimon. Jamie Dimon is not someone that under normal circumstances would say anything like that. He's too busy trying to get people to invest with him. But he's turned around and he is sounding a very serious alarm. It's a little late in the game, to be blunt, but he's quite sincere. You've got to look at all of the leaders in the financial sector. You know, look, somebody like Luke Groman is very knowledgeable, good analyst. Go to Jeffrey Gundlach, who is probably the most brilliant of all. Then you have Alistair MacLeod on gold. I would encourage all of your viewers, go listen to these people.
Absolutely.
I'm not a financial analyst. It's not my forte. But I can listen and learn, and I can see a serious crisis coming when it's coming. We're on the verge of that. You know, one of the things that somebody asked me, which will happen first? Will we be back at war in the Middle East and potentially with Russia by September? Or do we have a financial collapse between now and September? And I said, I don't know which comes first, but I think they're both very, very likely at this stage. Well, I don't see how we weather this.
I agree with you. And I've also done an analysis of the stablecoin, the attempt to sell more treasuries into the new stablecoin markets enabled by the Genius Act. So I've crunched the numbers on this, Colonel. At best, the Trump administration will only be able to raise about $1 trillion. It's not small change, but compared to $37 trillion in national debt, it's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. If Trump doesn't get the debt to GDP ratio down to something closer to 70%, you know, those 10-year rates are going to stay above 5% consistently. And then we're in, you know, a catastrophe, as you said. But the stablecoin situation is not going to solve this.
No, but I think Scott Bessent has gone into this with the hope that it can postpone a disaster. I think that's about the best that he can hope from this operation. And listen, I think Scott Bessent is a brilliant man, and I think he's largely correct in most of what he has to say. But this is beyond his control, and this is not the 1970s. You can't put Paul Volcker in there and then stick us all into a cold shower and say, suck it up, it's the only way forward. I think we have to consider what nobody wants to consider, which is default. But let me back up now and say, we defaulted twice. You've got to go back and look at FDR during the Depression. I think it was once in 34, once in 36. May have the dates wrong, but they didn't call it a default. We simply went to our creditors and said, look, we can't pay the interest. Now, why did the creditors listen to us? Well, they had two reasons. One, we were sitting on top of the largest manufacturing base in the world. We had the largest skilled labor force in the world, okay? And we had demanded that our creditors from World War I pay us in gold. So we had a steady flow of gold into the United States. So the creditors said, okay, we'll restructure. You don't have to pay everything. We'll work out a different plan. And we got through this. Ultimately, in 1939, when the Germans invaded Poland, you had Morgenthau, the treasurer, who testified before the Senate and said, we've done everything we can. We don't know what to do now, Frank. I wish I could tell you something. Everything we've tried has failed. Well, he was right. And it's ultimately the war that dragged us out of the Depression. But my point to you is that we have defaulted in the past. Nixon's decision to temporarily depart from the gold standard, remember it was a temporary measure.
Yes, 1971, temporary.
It was also a form of default.
Uh-huh.
Because LBJ had run the country into the ground. People don't realize that we had spent ourselves into oblivion, not only in Vietnam, which was a catastrophe for us, a waste on a scale no one today can even begin to imagine, worse than Ukraine. In addition to that, we also had the problem of the great war on poverty. So we were spending at home, spending it overseas, and we went bankrupt. to get out of it, we went off the gold standard. Uh-huh. Now, what are we going to do today? Do we have the largest manufacturing base in the world?
Nope.
No. And do we have people, bringing shiploads of gold into New York Harbor to put in, into New York City under the sidewalks? No. So I think we're in a lot of trouble. And, there's been an unwillingness to do an ends means analysis, an unwillingness to stand up and say, wait a minute, this is crazy. Why are we engaged all over Asia militarily? China is not going to attack us. China's not massing armies on the borders of Southeast Asia. We're saying, well, look, they're practicing for a potential assault on Taiwan. Well, given all of our threats to go into Taiwan and use it as a platform for attack against China, I'm not terribly surprised by that, but there's still 100 miles of water. Good luck if you think you're going to invade that thing. I don't think it's going to work out very well even now. But, the notion that China is constantly testing us and all of its neighbors, it's not true. The Japanese and the Chinese are doing business in their own currency. The Japanese have absolutely told us to fly a kite on Russia. The Japanese have said, no, we're not going to abide by these sanctions. We're going to continue to do business with the Russians. We need their oil and gas. We're losing this battle, if you understand me.
And we're punishing Japan with punitive tariffs. Trump, why does Trump choose our allies to punish? And then part of the settlement there, it just shows the utter lack of knowledge among the White House, saying, well, Japan's going to open its market to U.S. automobiles and U.S. grown rice. If there's two things that the Japanese people don't want from the USA, it's cars and rice. I can't make this up.
No, you can't. I think there are a couple of things that are wrong here. A friend that knows Trump, he's a mutual friend of me and President Trump. And keep in mind, I've always liked President Trump. Sure. I still like him. I don't agree with what the hell he's doing, but I like him. But this friend said something to me. He said, Doug, you have to understand President Trump believes bullying people works. In other words, he thinks if you bully and threaten, you're going to get somewhere. You're going to get what you want. I was a little skeptical of the whole thing till I picked up a book, a very good book, by the way, the other day that I've had for some time, but I hadn't had time to read through it. It's by Fred Kaplan. It's called The Bomb. And it's a very good discussion of presidents and generals and the secret history of nuclear war. Now, I don't know Fred Kaplan, but he wrote a good book. And one of the anecdotes that he recounts in there is under the Bush administration, we wanted to negotiate an agreement with the Russians concerning nuclear arsenals. And Donald Trump in New York City got wind of this and asked, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of State, can I talk to the negotiator and give him some advice? I know how to do this. I'm a great negotiator. He said, sure. So he went to see the man who was leading the team to negotiate this arrangement. And he said, here's what you do when you get there and you walk into the room with the Soviets. You put your finger in the chest of the Soviet leader who's leading the team to negotiate this arrangement, and you say, screw you.
and that's supposed to set the tone for?
Well, the thing
for
is,
compromise?
He used a less polite word than I did when I said screw. But the point is that this is supposed to set the tone in his mind based on his infinite successful business experience in New York City. Fortunately, the man who led the team paid no attention to it. We did get an agreement. It took almost 2 years. And that's the other thing that President Trump didn't seem to understand, that you have to sit there when you take over the White House and you have to say, all right, how many things can I accomplish in my time here in the 4 years that I'm going to be here? You should come up with maybe the top five. You should then look at the top five and say, what can I get done quickly? And focus on those, one, two, maybe three. And then the others, you have to understand, it's going to take time. If you want to negotiate new trade relations with China, well, that's going to take months, if not years. That's right. The nature of the beast. That's not abnormal. That's the way it is.
Right. And I would add, Colonel, that if you run around the world telling everybody, screw you, then all those nations are just going to turn around and say, screw the dollar. And they're going to join BRICS.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
It's and by the way, I saw this recently. Somebody said it, this confrontation at a conference between an African leader named Traoré or something, and Senator Vance. This is shortly before the election. And it was very interesting to listen to it because it was a complete failure to understand that much of the world feels as though it's being exploited by us. Now, President Trump has presented the picture to us as though we have been exploited by everybody else.
I know.
The truth is, it's a two-way street. And so you're absolutely right. You can't start a new relationship if you're a new president with anybody taking that position. But he believes that. And trying to derail these bad policies apparently is very difficult. Some people can do that. Some people can stand back and say, look, we tried it, it didn't work. We're going to take a different approach. And we'll provide information on that approach in the future. Next question. I don't see him doing that. I don't see him admitting that anything he has said or done might not have been the right answer under any circumstances. So I think ego and everything with him is mortgaged to vanity, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
Is it impossible for him to be agile in his thinking or behavior?
Well, and,
so I don't see anything good happening.
And we're about out of time. We're going to wrap this up shortly, but I would just add that also, I believe that Trump does not realize the interconnectedness of the global supply chain at this moment in history. As an example, my own company, you know, we do food manufacturing, fulfillment, we have warehouse operations, everything. We were trying to buy about $1 million machine from Italy that would help automate some of our manufacturing. And then he slaps a 30% tariff on the EU. So now it's a $1.3 million machine and we can't get it. But that would help if we got the, see, but that machine's not made anywhere else. Yeah. You know?
Hey, listen, you're preaching to the choir and you're talking about the externalities of the market, of the marketplace, you know, the unanticipated consequences.
Yeah.
No, he's not being involved with that. And this is not someone who's manufactured anything.
That's right.
He's also surrounded by what I would call financial capitalists. Everything in New York City is financialized. They're not creating anything. They're not building anything. They're essentially charging transaction fees.
That's right.
And that's, most of the people around Trump have made themselves into billionaires by moving money from point A to point B to point C and collecting transaction fees along the way.
Yeah.
It's not production. And well, this nation between 18, I would argue this nation between 1865 and 1955 was built by production capitalists.
That's right.
They produced something.
And that's what my company does here in Texas. We produce things. And Trump, in some ways, makes it more difficult than it should be. But Colonel, I want to give out your website again. It's douglasmcgregor.com. I want to encourage everybody to check out your site. Check out your videos. You're a frequent guest with Judge Napolitano and others. And here's some of your videos here. Is there anything else you want to add before we wrap this up, Colonel?
No, just that, you know, fasten your seatbelts. You're going to go on a roller coaster ride over the next 12 months. And I can't predict where it will end, but I don't see good things in sight. At some point, we're going to have to put the brakes on and change direction. Because the direction we're headed in right now is not good.
Okay. Thank you for your analysis, Colonel. Have a great day. Appreciate your time. Be well.
Right. Same to you. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. And thank all of you for watching. This has been another very important interview here on Brighttown.com. Feel free to repost this interview on other channels. And we'll be doing articles about this interview at naturalnews.com as well. Just some analysis and some snippets that we'll put out there on social media. So thank you for watching today. God bless you all. God bless America. Take care. When you're ready for the cleanest, most nutrient-dense foods and superfoods and nutritional supplements, personal care products, do yourself a favor, do your health a favor, and shop with us at healthrangerstore.com. We have our own mass spec laboratory where we do our own in-house testing for heavy metals, for glyphosate, for bacteria, yeast, and mold, and E. coli, and salmonella, and so much more. We do more extensive testing for the cleanliness and the authenticity of foods than any other company that I've ever heard of. And you can get all of this right now, the cleanest, most nutrient-dense foods at healthrangerstore.com. Plus, all these amazing categories, we've got personal care solutions for you, from toothpaste and shampoo and body soap to preparedness items such as freeze-dried fruits and superfoods in number 10 cans that are sealed and good for very long-term shelf-stable storage. We've got home care products such as cleaning concentrates and laundry detergents, automatic dishwasher detergent, and so on. And of course, we never use fragrance chemicals. We never use artificial dyes. We never use fillers or garbage or anything like that. Nearly everything that we sell is certified organic and non-GMO. And even our vitamin C is non-China vitamin C, non-GMO vitamin C. So shop with us. You'll be glad you did. And we have freeze-dried tart cherries available right now in number 10 cans and in pouches. And those are delicious. You can eat them like snacks. You'll love those. So check it all out at healthrangerstore.com. And thank you for supporting us. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. Take care.